की जाए, नामाचार्य हरिदास ठाकुर की जाए, प्रेम से कहो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासदि गौर भक्तवृंद की जाए, श्री श्री राधा कृष्ण गोप गोपीनाथ श्याम कुंड राधा कुंड गिरि गोवर्धन की जाए, श्री वृंदावन धाम की जाए, श्री मथुर धाम की जाए, श्री नवद्वीप मायापुर धाम की जाए, श्री श्री जगन्नाथ पुरी धाम की जाए, गंगा माई की जाए, जमुना माई की जाए, भक्ति देवी तुलसी महारानी की जाए, समवेत भक्ति वृंद की जाए, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, go premanandi. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Better. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So, what I'm going to do this evening, first of all, I'd like to thank our host, Kushan. Kaushal. Now, what? How do you? Kushan. Kushan. Like Kushan. All right, Kushan Prabhu, and your wife's name?
Preeta.
Preeta. All right, Preeta. Okay, thank you very much. Very kind of you to host this gathering, and thank you all for coming. I know this is a weeknight, so probably you've all got work to do in the morning. So it's very nice that you're spending a little time to hear something a little about Srila Prabhupada. This morning, we started off, usually when I travel, I have a seminar called Srila Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam, and wherever I go, then I talk on different topics, but directly related to Srila Prabhupada's personal activities. And this morning, the devotees at the temple decided that we should talk about the topic of chanting, so I'm going to continue on where I left off this morning. This morning I gave a background about Srila Prabhupada's coming to the West, what his focus was, what his intent was, of course, in introducing the holy names all over the world, and even that he had that ambition right from the 1930s when he was living in Allahabad. So Prabhupada, of course, when he came to the West, was very determined that he was not going to give anything other than pure bhakti. He wasn't interested in, you know, presenting another edition of the Hindu religion. He was interested in presenting the pure, unalloyed practices of bhakti yoga. And he stuck with that, and he wasn't really concerned, in one sense, whether he got a good audience or not. He was not going to change his message. So, you know, by determination, by his purity, and most of all by his faith in the holy names, gradually something began, and ISKCON, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, that he founded in July of 1966 in New York, gradually began to expand. So I read this morning one quote from Srila Prabhupada when he was in Vrindavan in 1975, where he recalled how in the early days in 26 Second Avenue they were chanting, and not very early, 7 in the morning, and the neighbors were all complaining, the other tenants in the building, and sometimes they would call the police to have them stop, but Prabhupada wouldn't stop, and he continued on chanting anyway. Also, when they went out to chant in Tompkins Square Park that first time, I think that was like August of 1966, and that was also a bold move. The young men that were coming to 22nd Avenue, they didn't mind joining in and chanting in the storefront there. That was kind of like a little insular, and they had their own little scene going on there that was, you know, separate from what was the rest of what was going on in New York. But of course, Prabhupada, you know, had bigger plans, and so as soon as he got them a little competent in chanting, then because the weather was nice, he just decided, all right, now let's go out and chant in public. So he personally walked down to Tompkins Square Park. The boys were following him. They were all very nervous. Sasrup Maharaj describes that in the Lilamrita. And they got to the park. Prabhupada immediately sat down on the grass and began chanting. And then they had a chanting session, and immediately a big crowd gathered around. I think the first session went for several hours, and then gradually people that were musicians, they joined in, they came and brought their own instruments, and it became a regular feature for a short while in the park there. So what I heard, and I don't think this is in the Lilamrita, but what I heard was that as soon as they sat down and started chanting and this crowd gathered, the park warden became a little annoyed, and apparently after some time then he came over when the chanting had stopped, and then he called Prabhupada's attention to a sign that was there, keep off the grass. And of course Prabhupada was sitting on the grass, so he didn't like them sitting on the grass and making this crowd on his grass. So he said, you have to move. So Prabhupada very, you know, humbly, all right, no argument, he moved. He simply walked off the grass and sat on the pathway. And then everybody else sat down on the pathway and he continued on chanting. So that was Srila Prabhupada. He wasn't going to stop. He knew what his business was about. And somehow or another, he was going to push ahead with that program. So that determination to chant under any circumstances, or even, you know, if there was some objection from the city authorities or from the police, that his disciples inherited the same mentality. Of course, it was fueled by Srila Prabhupada himself. I'll relate a few incidences from the early days here in Australia to illustrate that. But at the same time, Prabhupada was pragmatic. It's not like he was fanatic. He was very determined, and he was prepared to go against the local authorities if he felt it was necessary. But at the same time, if he could achieve his purpose without confrontation, he was also, you know, keen to do that. So in 1968, this is 24th of December, a letter, Prabhupada was in Los Angeles. He got a letter from Chidananda Das, who was one of his early disciples. Of course, this was at a time when ISKCON was just beginning to take off. Up until 1968, there were five temples. Or by 1968, there were five temples, four in America and one in Montreal. And there were about 60 initiated disciples, so it took 2 years to get to that point. But then from the end of 68 to about the end of 71, that four-year period, ISKCON went from that five temples to about 55 temples, and it also went from about 60 initiated disciples to over 600. So in that four-year period, beginning 68 onwards, ISKCON, you know, increased its size by 10 times the amount. And then from 72 to 77, of course, it went up to 108 temples and about 5,000 initiated disciples. So, you know, there was this remarkable expansion. And, you know, from 68 or 69 onwards, you know, of course, devotees started traveling alone to, you know, places like Australia. Balimardhan and Upendra came here. the three householder couples, they went, you know, to London, they started there. Shivananda went on his own to Germany, he started there. And in this way, you know, by the end of 71, ISKCON was on every continent on the planet and, you know, rapidly growing. So as more and more people joined ISKCON, then Prabhupada had to devise programs to keep them all fully engaged in devotional service. So you'll see from about 1969, well, December 69, Prabhupada installed Radha Lundanishwara. They were the first big Radha Krishna deities in ISKCON. He installed them in London at Bury Place. And then after that, very rapidly, deities were established in many temples in various countries. Last year we just celebrated the 40th anniversary of the installation of Radha Gopinath. That was in 1971 in Sydney. Next year you'll be celebrating the 40th anniversary of Sri Sri Radha Balabha's installation, right? Next year? Yes, 2013, 1973.
With that installation in Sydney, that was at the old temple.
That, yes, they were installed, Radha Balabha were installed at 14 Burnett Street, St Kilda. Yeah. We didn't come here till 1975.
No, but I mean in Sydney as well, I know.
Well, in Sydney, Radha Gopinath were installed in Paddington. There was a small storefront there. And then they had many places.
So what happens when they need to be moved?
Well, moving deities is always tricky. If they're small deities, it's not so much of a problem. But if they're big deities, you know, it's a problem. And generally, once you install deities, you're not supposed to move them. But anyway, that's, we're going off track there a little bit. But my point is that Prabhupada had to engage all these people that were coming forward to serve Krishna. And of course, the main engagement was chanting in the early part of, you know, ISKCON's development. And then as Prabhupada got this book trust established, the BBT, it was ISKCON Press to begin with, then it became the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust. Then Prabhupada started putting more emphasis on selling his books rather than just going out and just chanting. But it was definitely a very pronounced emphasis on, you know, going out, preaching. Not that people were, you know, told just come and sit down in the temple and chant all day, or, you know, eat and sleep. Prabhupada wanted them out active, preaching Krishna consciousness every day. So, you know, when we all joined the temple, that was it. The very first day you joined the temple, you were out on Sankirtan, you know, 6-8 hours a day. And that was the entire scope of the temple's activities, practically, apart from, you know, the Sunday feasts. But there was no congregational preaching in those days, no bhakti vrikshas, you know, nothing of the sort. It was, you were either in the temple or you were out. That was it. And if you were in the temple, it was ashram living. And every day you were out on Sankirtan without fail, chanting or selling Prabhupada's books. So that was how the movement spread very, very rapidly, because we were very visible, very much in contact with the public, and, you know, selling lots of books and chanting. So this led to Chidananda on the 24th of December 1968. They were already starting to have some problems with going out and chanting. So Prabhupada replies that regarding chanting in the street, chased by the police is not good at all. The best thing is to invite people to our temple and chant peacefully. If a person can sell from 7 to 12 magazines individually, then there's no need of making a procession of chanters and thereby disturbing the police equilibrium. If you can sell Back to Godhead individually, as proposed by you, and some copies of our books, like Bhagavad Gita as it is, that will be a great success, and there is no need of leading a procession of chanters for this purpose. So that was at the end of 68. Back to Godhead had just started to come into regular production. Prabhupada, of course, made Back to Godhead his main vehicle for preaching in from 1944 when the first edition came out on the Vyasa Pooj day of his Guru Maharaj. He published, I think, two editions in 44. And then when he retired from family life, actually producing, the writing and producing the Bhakti Godhead became his main focus of his preaching, or one of the main focuses, up until 1960, when he began work on his Bhagavatams. 1960, actually about 12 editions of BTG came out. Then Prabhupada put it aside and started working on the Bhagavatam full time. So it was kind of suspended but not forgotten. And as soon as he got a following, and especially the kinds of devotees that he was attracting, Hayagriva was an English professor teaching at, you know, university. They were all, Kintananda, all the Umapati, Sasrup, they were all college graduates. So they're all very educated and literate persons. So Prabhupada, in order to, one, give them some engagement, and two, increase the preaching, he handed the BTG to his disciples and told them, now this is your vehicle for preaching, or one of your vehicles for preaching. So BTG became quickly established, and at a certain point they moved into a, you know, professional level. They got Dai Nippon from Japan, one of the biggest printing companies there. They put in a regular order, I think it might have been 20,000 issues a month they had to guarantee. And then, you know, of course, with that number of magazines coming out, then they were dispersed amongst the temples and there was a lot of pressure on everybody to go out and sell the BTGs. So Prabhupada was saying there that now if you can go out and sell back to Godhead, that's better than just chanting. And similarly, of course, his Bhagavad Gita as it is, just at that time being accepted by Macmillan, and they published the abridged edition, so that was also available for sale. So as soon as some literature came out, Prabhupada was pushing his disciples to sell that. Otherwise, you know, we were out chanting. And although he says there being chased by the police is not good, but there were places where, you know, we were regularly chased by the police, and Prabhupada told us to just keep on going with our program regardless. London was one of the first places, you know, outside of America to be opened up. I mean, it was the first place. And in London they had lots of problems with the police for several years. You know, they were being harassed and arrested and taken to court, etc., etc. And similarly also here in Australia we had the same experience. When I joined at the beginning of 1972 in Sydney, that time I think there were about 10 devotees in the Sydney temple, and there were four or five, or maybe half a dozen here in Melbourne. And that was it. That was the entire Australian yatra. So that was, I joined in mid-February. By the time Prabhupada came on the 1st of April, 6 weeks later, we had 44 devotees in the Sydney temple. We went from, you know, 10 or 12 up to 44. So practically almost there was a new person joining practically every single day. It was very dynamic. It was very exciting. And everybody that joined was immediately put out. As I said, the next day you were out on Sankirtan chanting. So at that time our, you know, Sankirtan activities comprised of standing on a street corner, the same street corner, for 4 or 5 hours chanting. There was a, I forget the cross street now in Sydney, it was on Pitt Street and Macquarie or something like that. There was some, you know, corner spot there that, you know, was just nice. You could stand there for a few hours. And of course, you know, originally there were 4 or 5 devotees that would go out and just chant there, so it wasn't so much of a, you know, an event. But with all these new devotees joining, it very rapidly we got up to a, you know, a Sankirtan, daily Sankirtan party of about 20 or 25 devotees. So they were standing on the street corner in the same place, everybody chanting for 4 or 5 hours. It wasn't long before all the people that were working in the city block, you know, in the city offices there, started complaining because it was driving them crazy. Actually, some years back, somebody told me that they were out and somebody came. They were quite favorable, but they said that their first introduction to Hare Krishna was that they, in the early 70s, they were an office worker downtown Sydney, and Hare Krishna's used to chant just below their building, and he said it was driving us all crazy. He said we were all, you know, complaining, and we'd go home and all we could remember, you know, hear was Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. But that person later on, you know, became actually very favorable. But, you know, initially it was a big disturbance for people, and so they started complaining, you know, and we were expanding very rapidly, and the more we expanded, the bigger the Sankirtan party got. So after a short period, the the council officers and then the police, they started harassing us, and there was, in the downtown police station in Sydney, there was one particular officer who, you know, really hated us. And whenever he was on duty, then he would make it his business, you know, to get the Hare Krishnas off the street. And I remember several times, you know, we would line up on, George Street, Pitt Street, on Pitt Street, and in front of Woolworths. And we would line up, about 25 of us in a long line, and we'd all, you know, start chanting, and we'd all be doing the Swami step, you know, right leg over the left leg over the right leg, everybody swaying with their arms up, and chanting. And then after about 5 minutes, then suddenly we'd see, you know, a paddy wagon, coming, police wagon, coming around the corner. And then we, you know, keep on chanting, but we'd watch to see whether they were going to go past, or whether they would stop. And they would, you know, invariably stop, and then the cops would jump out, and then we would all just run. And, you know, we'd run across the road, we'd run down the street, we'd run into the shops, and the cops would try and grab whoever they could get a hold of. And, you know, generally speaking, whoever was playing the mridanga, they would get caught because it was difficult to run with the drum. And Dwipayana, I think he was around at that time, he used to play his guitar, so he got caught a couple of times, you know, because he was playing his guitar, couldn't run very fast. And I remember even we ran into Myers, yeah, because, you know, that's the big department store in Sydney, Myers. M-Y-E-R, not M-A-Y-A. And of course it was an upscale shop. And generally what happened was that when you ran into one of the shops, the cops wouldn't follow you in. But there was one occasion, I remember, I ran in with a couple of other devotees into Myers, and the cop actually ran in after us, and he chased us through the store. And we ran up the escalators, there was the women's you know, clothing department, and we saw, you know, all the racks of dresses are hanging there, so we ran into the dress racks and hid between the dresses, and he was looking, he couldn't see us, and he went off. So anyway, it was a lot of fun, and you know, occasionally somebody would get caught, and you know, then they get booked. And but it did get to a point where it became almost impossible to set out on the pavement because, you know, they were so determined to stop us. And even one point, I remember the Sankirtan party was out on one place. A couple of the ladies were, you know, going off shop, doing some shopping, deity shopping. And the police saw them walking down the street and stopped and arrested them just for walking down the street because they were Hare Krishnas. So, you know, it was a bit of a, you know, fair bit of harassment was going on. And so at one point, the temple president, his name was Mohanananda, Chiru was the vice president. So Mahanananda, actually, he was my first temple president. He was 19 years old. He had been sent from America to help develop the Yatra in Sydney. He was 19. So he was a redhead as well, so he was quite hot-headed. Anyway, they had to try to think of, you know, ways of doing Sankirtan. We were getting arrested, practically speaking, as soon as we got out on the street. You know, we could only chant for 5 or 10 minutes, and then the cops would come. So it was becoming difficult. So then we tried a different strategy. Instead of having everybody standing on one street corner, what we did was divide off into pairs. And then we would have two devotees standing on every street corner. Yeah, and one would chant with the karatals, and the other one would sell back to Godheads, and then after half an hour, you'd switch off. But that also, you know, the police didn't like that. They'd already, by that time, they'd gotten to the point they just wanted to get rid of us. So we were still getting arrested. And then Mahanananda thought, well, all right, let's try something else. So we tried doing door-to-door, you know, going to people's homes, just door-knocking. But that also was not very successful because in the daytime everybody was at work. So we spent most of our time banging on, you know, the doors of empty houses. So it wasn't very satisfactory. Then in, I think, about May of 72, Madhadvisa Swami came. He was an American devotee who joined in 68 in San Francisco. And he had been preaching in India for a couple of years. And then he came to Australia. So then he devised a new tactic. And we would go out on Naga Sankirtan, or, you know, walking Sankirtan. And maybe five or six of us, not a big party. And we would go and we would start at the top end of Pitt Street, maybe at the town hall. And then we'd go down one side of the street and just keep on moving and chanting as we were moving. And we would do that for several hours. So because we were moving, nobody, you know, was exposed to the chanting for too long. So they didn't really get annoyed with us. And that was quite successful. But the town, you know, city authorities had already gotten to the point where they just decided we're going to get rid of these people and get them off the street for good. So what happened then was that they started coming out, like they would send a team, one man with a camera, one man with a notebook, and we'd be chanting, and then they would stop us. They wouldn't force us, you know, off the street, but what they did was they would take everybody's photograph, and then they would take your name. So the guy would, you know, click your photograph, and the other guy with the notebook, it would say, right, son, what's your name? And we would say, Prasadam Das, or Samsara, or whatever. We give some, you know, bogus name. And they would write, you know, write it all down. And every day they were doing that. So they were building up a case. So we heard that, you know, they were going to bring this big case against us and have us banned. Because one thing that was to our advantage is that we were not a legal entity. ISKCON at that time was an unregistered, what is it? I forget the technical name now. Not unincorporated. Anyway, we were an unregistered society, so we had no legal identity. Yeah. In those days, they allowed you know, we were able to open bank accounts in ISKCON's name, even though we didn't actually technically legally exist. For legal purposes, there was nothing, there was nobody to sue. They couldn't sue ISKCON because it didn't exist. So the only thing that they could do was try to prosecute the individuals. So that worked to our advantage, of course. At one point, then Chiru, late in 1972, at the end of August, he wrote to Srila Prabhupada and asked what to do. You know, because we heard this big court case is going to come up, and what should we do? Should we hire lawyers? That will cost a lot of money. Should we stop doing Sankirtan? Should we keep on doing Sankirtan? You know, it was a puzzle. So he wrote to Srila Prabhupada, And then on the 10th of September 1972, Prabhupada wrote back. So he said, "My dear Charu, please accept my blessings. I'm in due receipt of your letter, dated August the 31st, 1972, and I have noted the contents carefully. Now, regarding this business of Sankirtan, the solution is to simply go on with Sankirtan activities as you have been doing, and let them arrest us if they like, but we will not stop. Just like in London, they became arrested so many times, and there was so much public display of arresting, that gradually the police stopped arresting, and now they have Sankirtan anywhere they like, without any botheration. If we take this case to court, and spend so much money for big lawyers, and still if we do not win, then they will have a legal right to stop us. So, better to forget this business of lawyers and judges, and simply go on with Sankirtan. That is the civil disobedience movement. Let them fill their jails with us again and again, but we shall not stop our Sankirtan movement. Also, it may help to, if you get some public sympathy through publicizing our constant persecution in the newspaper journals. Gradually, the city officials and constabulary will become embarrassed to arrest us further, and gradually we'll be allowed to carry on our Sankirtan unhampered. But I do not think that this business of expensive lawyers and going to court will solve anything. Better to simply become determined to hold our Sankirtan in our own manner as we like, and simply depend on Krishna and his protection at all times. Hoping this meets you in good health, your ever well wisher, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami." And that, of course, that was typed out and signed. And then at the bottom of the letter, Prabhupada had written a postscript in his own handwriting. And he says, "P.S. There is no difference between our chanting on the street, or in the temple, or in jail. A Krishna-conscious person is not afraid of any place, but he wants to chant constantly in all circumstances." So that was it. We got that letter. You know, Prabhupada's word was the final word. So we just, you know, continued on. We didn't go to court. They did bring the case to court eventually. And we didn't even go to the court to attend it, the hearing, because we were all out in Sankirtan. And you know, we just depended on Krishna, and we actually won the case. So it was quite amusing, because what happened was that when they went to court, they had to, you know, prosecute, as I said, each individual person. So when they brought the cases up before the judge, then they would say, "Prasadam Das, you know, it's on such and such a day, you know, Pitt Street, blah, blah, blah." And then the judge said, "Well, where is this Prasadam Das? Who is he? Does he even live in Sydney anymore?" And nobody turned up for the case from our side. No, what to speak about a lawyer, nobody else was there. And so, you know, all the people that were listed there as offenders, the judge didn't even know that they existed, you know. And he asked that question, "Well, do they even live in Sydney anymore? Maybe they've gone to another city." So like that, he actually dismissed the whole case. And at the end of it, he added a comment that he said, "I think they add a lot of color to the city." So he had apparently seen us chanting there and liked it. And he was a little favorable. So it became a big scandal in the newspapers, actually. So anyway, in Melbourne here, you know, the persecution that we had went on for many years. There was in Sydney, after this big court case and they lost it, they got criticized for it very heavily, so they kind of backed off. And we also gradually moved over to book distribution, because book distribution also became a big controversial affair, and we were getting arrested for that too for many years. But in Melbourne here, they used to regularly arrest the devotees just for chanting, and that went on for a long time, you know, about 4 or 5 years. There was one fellow, Kulma knows his Kami name, we used to call him Square Jaw. He was a little fat chubby guy with, you know, a thick neck, so we would call him Square Jaw. Yeah, and he was ferocious. He memorized the names of every devotee in the temple. He knew our Kami names, he knew our devotee names. And he would also regularly check the police records to see who had fines against them. And he would, because they were not allowed to arrest us themselves, they had to get the police to do the arrest. So he would regularly get a couple of police, take them in tow, and then try and, you know, track us down in the city here. You know, if they saw somebody that had fines, he knew everybody, so he knew what fines they had, and then he would tell the police, all right, arrest him. And because we had a tactic, because Prabhupada had said, you know, try and get public sympathy. So if they did get somebody on the street, then sometimes, you know, we would run into the middle of the road when they were chasing you so that everybody could see. And then the cops would try and grab you, and then, you know, the devotee would throw themselves on the floor and chant Hare Krishna. And then the police actually had to physically lift them up and carry them over and throw them in their wagon. So all the people, you know, they all would gather up and they would, you know, be very unhappy with the police. Well, you know, why don't you get a decent job? You know, why don't you find some real criminals, you know?
I've got some good news about Square Jaws. He comes and eats in Crossway 3-4 times a week.
You're joking.
Yeah. Since retirement.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. I never heard that. Yeah. He was ferocious. Yeah. He was really ferocious. He comes and eats in Crossways. That's amazing. Anyway, their exposure to the holy names. He probably chanted Hare Krishna more than the devotees did. That's far out.
He still comes.
Anyway, in those days, I mean, he was so bad. And sometimes, you know, he would come up. I remember there was one devotee, Pandava. And he would, you know, there's that paragraph in the Krishna book about Kamsa and how, you know, he was being ill-advised by his counselors. The demonic Kamsa would persecute the devotees. So Pandava would make him stand there and he would read that, you know, little paragraph out, but he would substitute Square Jaw for Kamsa. He would be furious. And sometimes, you know, if he didn't get us on the street, he even started coming to the temple. And when we were in Burnett Street in St. Kilda, he would sometimes raid the temple at 6 o'clock in the morning. I mean, he was so keen to get us. So, you know, he would come with the police and they would come, you know, just barge into the temple with their shoes on. And we would all be chanting japa at that time. And then they would grab whoever Square Jaw, you know, could identify. And so after, you know, once or twice... It wasn't a frequent event, but it was, you know, it happened a few times. And I remember one time, well, what we did was actually the Burnett Street Temple had, you know, there was the front road and then there was a laneway at the back. So we would keep the van, temple van, parked in the back lane. And if the police came, then anybody that had fines, they would run out the back. The cops would always come in the front. And they never twigged on that there was a back laneway. So we would keep the van there and then everybody would run out the back, jump in the van and then drive off to Albert Park and chant japa, you know, for an hour. And then we'd go back and the cops had already gone. So they never kind of twigged on to that one. But one day I remember a few of the devotees jumped in the van and drove off. And myself and Sanak, he was the temple president at that time. We didn't get in the van. I didn't know that I had any fines, but apparently I did. I had about $40 worth. And so when they came in, Square Jaw immediately got me. Oh, you know, Dennis Harrison, Harry Sori Das, $40. And that was it. So I got arrested. And Sanak also, he had quite a lot of fines, maybe about $400. So they grabbed him as well. So they took us to the St. Kilda Watch House. And they put us in the cell there. And then in the afternoon, they came back and Sanat, because the amount that Sanat owed, so that what the system was, if you owed a fine, they could arrest you, and then they put you in jail, and each day in jail was equivalent to like $20 or $40 or something like that. And so you had to serve the time if you didn't pay the fine. So Sanak's bill, his fines were so high that they couldn't keep him in the St. Kilda Watch House, because that's like just a temporary holding place. So they took him in the afternoon to, what is this place here?
Pantridge.
Yes, they put him in the main jail. But my fines was just like worth 2 days. So I was supposed to spend 2 days and two nights there in jail, and that, you know, that was it. So the cop in the morning, he came and he tried to give me something in the evening to eat, because they have to feed you also. And I wouldn't eat it. He gave me a pie, right? They'd gone down to the shop or something and bought a meat pie. And I wouldn't eat it because it was meat. So then the next morning, he came back again about 8 in the morning, and he said, you know, here's your breakfast, it's vegetarian. So I said, I'm sorry, I can't eat that. He said, what do you mean you can't eat it? I said, well, it's not offered. So he looked puzzled and he said, what do you mean it's not offered? He said, I went down to the store, I bought the pie, I brought it back, and now I'm offering it to you. So I said, no, I said, it's not been offered to Krishna on the altar, so we can't eat it. So off he went, and then after 5 minutes, the desk sergeant came back. He said, what's this? You know, you're not eating. I said, no, I'm not going to eat anything unless it's offered to Krishna. It has to be cooked by the devotees. So he said, all right. He said, you, out. And he threw me out. He sent me back to the temple. They gave me my beads back, and he didn't want any trouble. So, because I was only there for another day, he just sent me out. But Sanak was in for about 10 days. Anyway, I mean, there was lots of stuff. If you've been on Kuma's website, there's a famous picture of him being upended and carried along the street. He's still playing the drum. He's back.
What did Sanak do for the 10 days before? The food for Sanak, what happened?
Well, they all, they, that was the other thing that we did to get public sympathy. We started, they all went on hunger strikes, and they were just drinking water. That was it. Kuma also, he was put in for about 8 days. That one we set it up. You know, we informed the police, and we informed the newspapers when he was going to be out on the street chanting. And then the cops had to come and arrest him, and then the, you know, newspaper guys were all there, TV guys were there, and the whole thing was filmed. And then he was put in jail, and I think for about 8 days, and he fasted the whole time. And there were several other devotees that did the same thing. So we got a lot of public sympathy from that. It didn't stop there. When Square Jaw retired after a couple of years, then we thought, all right, now we'll get a bit of relief. But the guy that came on after him was 10 times worse than Square Jaw. He was a real demon. I mean, Square Jaw was kind of like a bit of a comical figure for us. We didn't really take him that seriously. And although, you know, I mean, he was determined to try to get us off the street. But the next guy that came had absolutely no Sukriti whatsoever. He was a real demon, and he was very nasty and very, you know, ferocious. And he, you know, for several years he harassed us as well. After that, then somehow or another, we made peace with the council.
Do we know if he was some other religion, this guy that was so bad?
I don't know anything about him. No, he was apparently some ex-army guy, and he was like really, really horrible person. But we had a kind of an affection for Square Jaw, I have to say. Just somehow, you know, he was our adversary. But, you know, we had a bit of fun with him sometimes, you know. But the other guy was completely, whoa, nasty, very nasty. Square Jaw wasn't really nasty in his own way. And I guess that's why he's coming to Crosswest now.
The other guy's not.
Huh?
The other guy's not. He had a serious accident.
He did, yes.
Probably.
No, he did. Coleman knows about that. I heard he had a really serious accident, and his family, you know, was all broken up, and he really got some bad reactions. Anyway, to get back to the to the story, so you know, I mean, this was a typical kind of scenario in many places around the world when the devotees started their preaching. You know, it was all, you know, out on the street, and of course we always kept coming up against the authorities, and that was Prabhupada's response, inevitably, that, you know, go on with your Sankirtan activities, and just, even if they arrest us, it doesn't matter, chanting Hare Krishna is the same in, you know, the temple, on the street, or in jail, just keep on chanting. So, on February the 4th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Mayapur. I just joined his personal party a couple of months before, at the end of November. And he got a letter from Caracas in South America. And they were also having the same kind of problem. They were just starting up. The police were harassing them. So they wrote to Srila Prabhupada to ask what to do. So that reminded Srila Prabhupada, because I was there, it reminded him of Sydney. So he asked me, what was that in Sydney? So I said, yes, in Sydney, they spent $10,000, the city council, compiling a case against us. Every day they used to come and film us and take names. And we didn't contest the case, but we just carried on with Sankirtan. And then the judge threw them out of court. They spent $10,000. It was a big scandal. And they lost the case. And the judge said, why not let them go on the streets? They add a lot of color to the city. So some newspaper reporter, you know, they couldn't figure out why are they, you know, spending so much time and money trying to get rid of a few people who were just singing and dancing. And so we had a lot of sympathy, actually. And one reporter, he actually investigated the whole thing, and he worked out that in wages and time and court fees and so many other things, the council actually spent $10,000 to bring this case. It doesn't sound a lot now, but in those days it was a huge amount of money. This is like 72, and that's 40 years ago. I mean, you know, that's like hundreds of thousands of dollars practically now, and they lost. You know, so it was printed in the newspaper that, you know, why is this going on like this? So it was very favorable for us in the long run. But so anyway, that was at the beginning of 76. Then towards the end of the year, we started getting reports about another kind of opposition that was coming, and that was from these deprogrammers, so-called deprogrammers. They were like people that were hired by parent groups who were opposed to their children becoming devotees, so-called children. They weren't even children anymore, they were adults. And they would hire these thugs to come and kidnap devotees, take them away and try and so-called deprogram them, and turn them back into normal meat-eating, you know, liquor-drinking sex mongers. So we first got news about this major court case that came up in New York at the end of October. Prabhupada was in Chandigarh, and then some news came through from, he was having a press conference, and a newspaper reporter said, now we heard that your people are being, you know, taken to court and prosecuted in New York. The charges were brainwashing, kidnapping, extortion. It was heavy stuff. Prabhupada had not heard any details at that point, but he immediately said, no, it's not true. It's all bogus. There's nothing. We're not doing anything wrong. And then later on we got more details. So in Los Angeles, Kulapriya Dasi, she had been captured on the street and taken someplace. Her parents had tried to, you know, so-called deprogram her. She escaped. She came back to the temple, and then she immediately brought a court case against the parents. And then in New York, there was one devotee, Basu Gopal. He had been kidnapped off the street. they took him someplace, and they kind of initially succeeded in getting him to give up his Krishna consciousness. And then later on, when they thought that he was back to normal, they actually let him out, and he was wandering around. And then he was going through the airport, I guess on his way back to his house or something. And because the airports in those days were full of Hare Krishna devotees selling books. And so he bumped into one of the devotees, and you know, it was like he was in a daze, but he kind of remembered, hey, I'm supposed to be a devotee. And so he asked the devotee, can you please take me to a temple? So they brought him back to the temple, and then they brought, you know, we made a complaint to the New York State Prosecutor's Office, and there was this young attorney there, Michael Schwed his name was, and so we made a complaint that these people are kidnapping our devotees, they're interfering with our rights for religious freedom, etc., etc. So he called a grand jury. In America they have some system, if it's a felony offense, then they call a grand jury, and then it's like a preliminary hearing, and then the grand jury hears the evidence and decides whether there's grounds for prosecution or not. So we asked for the grand jury, we made the complaint, but when it met, they didn't actually interview anybody from our side. They only spoke with some of the parents, and then the prosecutor brought a case against us. So we had made the complaint, and then we were made the defendants. So they brought these cases, and it was unprecedented. He brought an actual charge that we were brainwashing people, and there's no such term legally in America. Nobody had ever prosecuted a case on, you know, brainwashing, because you couldn't prove it, of course. And then also they concocted some other charges that we were kidnapping people or holding them, you know, against their will by brainwashing, and that we had tried to extort money from the family of Basa Gopal. So that was also bogus. Anyway, so it became a big case. And there were all these, you know, major legal challenges to ISKCON's existence in America. It was the first time, you know, after 10 years of preaching that, you know, it really started coming out. So, you know, we were in Vrindavan on November the 2nd in 1976. We'd been discussing the New York court case. And then also one thing was that Prabhupada had received a report from Balavanta Prabhu. He was the GBC for the southeast area of United States. So his area included Dallas and Dallas and Houston. And so he sent a report to Srila Prabhupada that one state legislator in Houston, he had appeared on TV. And he had made a statement that actually, he said, this Hare Krishna movement is spreading like an epidemic. He said, and if we don't stop them, within 10 years, they'll capture the government. So, you know, he was, you know, it wasn't a comical thing. He was a state legislator, so he made that. So that was reported to Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada was so happy when he heard that. Yeah, spreading like an epidemic. He loved that. So we were talking about the New York court case, and so Prabhupada said, so that is their feeling, means the, you know, materialists, that the Krishna consciousness movement is spreading so fast, like an epidemic, so we must take some steps to stop them. So then he turned to me, he said, and you said in Australia there was one man that if the people take to this movement, then where will everybody stand? What was that you said? So then I told him, yes, there was a psychiatrist in Sydney. So the city council had tried to have us banned from the city altogether, and they took us to court. We didn't contest the case, and they lost. And then afterwards they worked out they spent $10,000 and so much manpower to try and get rid of us, and it didn't work. And then one newspaper man, he went to a psychiatrist, I guess maybe it was a psychologist, and he asked him, can you explain why there's such a huge reaction against just a few people singing and dancing in the street? So he replied, basically it's because the city dwellers feel very threatened by our simple lifestyle. So Prabhupada said yes, he was very happy. He says, just see, so this whole Western civilization is threatened. He was very happy that he got that, you know, attention. So anyway, that's a bit of a background. Prabhupada's determination to, you know, chant Hare Krishna and get other people chanting Hare Krishna and fulfilling this, you know, prediction. It didn't happen easily. You know, everywhere that devotees went, there was opposition, there were problems, you know, there were fights with the police and the councils and so many other things, and then, you know, even with the parents. And so there was that opposition was there. I mentioned this morning about when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati began his preaching, you know, which of course that was the prototype, if you like, as Rabindra Sroop referred to it, the beta version of ISKCON. That was the Gaudiya Math. So when they started their preaching and they went to Vrindavan to do the parikrama for the first few times, then they were met with very hostile reactions from the villagers in the Vrindavan area, because Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was giving initiation to non-Brahmins. Mm. And so there was tremendous opposition stirred up by the Goswamis there and others. And sometimes when they went through a village, the whole place would be boarded up, all the shops would be closed, so they couldn't buy anything. And people would sometimes come out and harass them, they would throw rocks at them. So, you know, there was a lot of opposition. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, at one point there was a bounty. Some policeman was offered a bribe of 25,000 rupees, which in 1930s was like a fabulous amount of money. He was offered a bribe that we're going to kill this Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. You don't say anything, you know, here's the money. But he knew that he was a saintly person, so he went and informed him, be careful, there's a plot to kill you. So it was that bad. So in the similar way, I mean, when ISKCON was manifest, then also, you know, because I don't know about people trying to kill us, but certainly there was a lot of opposition. And then, of course, you only have to look at what happened in Russia in the 80s, and some of the devotees were actually killed. In jails and, you know, psychiatric hospitals and places like that. So it's not an easy thing to give people, you know, their ultimate benefit. People don't want it. They don't want to be told the truth. The truth hurts. And therefore people react against it. But Prabhupada always said, if you want to be a preacher, it is not an easy life. Yeah. If you want an easy life, then stay in the temple. If you want to preach, then you have to be prepared. There'll be opposition. Haridas Thakur, Jesus Christ, so many others. Okay, so how long are we going for tonight?
8:30.
What's our schedule? Cushion. What's our schedule? Well, I mean...
there's
prasadam. Let's do. We'll do one last little section, and then we'll finish at that point, and then you can distribute your prasadam. So, just to look at the meaning of chanting Hare Krishna, because Prabhupada often said it's a prayer. It means that we're asking Radharani, we're asking Krishna to please engage us in their devotional service. But one of the best explanations of the meaning of the chanting of Hare Krishna that I ever heard was in Chandigarh on October the 18th in 1976. Originally this was spoken by Prabhupada in Hindi, Later on, when I was working on this section of my book, Transcendental Diary, I had all the recordings, and they'd never been actually published, either in Hindi or English. And I got somebody to translate it, and I was very happy when I read the translation. So this was a little talk that Prabhupada gave at a person's house in Chandigarh. So we'd just done a 4 or 5 days Pandal program. There was about 5,000 people a night coming, so it was very successful. ISKCON was just beginning in Chandigarh at that time. We were staying at the house of Mr. P.L. Sethi, who was a big follower of Srila Prabhupada, and we were kind of temporarily using his house as an ISKCON center till we got our own place. So this particular night, October the 18th, Prabhupada had been invited to give a talk at the Rotary Club. So after the Rotary Club, instead of returning directly to Mr. Sethi's house, we took a detour. And we after a few minutes, we arrived at 1232 Sector 18C, which was a large three-story private house. There, Prabhupada was greeted with a garland by Mr. Budram Goyal, his wife and their two sons, his brother Mangat Ram, and other family members. Mr. Goyal is ISKCON's second life member in Chandigarh. Although not literate, he has a successful electronics business and is a prominent social worker. It is he who has provided all the prasadam for our devotees during their stay here in Chandigarh. There's about 30 odd devotees that came. A small pandal had been set up in the driveway of Mr. Goyal's house, and about 30 persons were in attendance at a program, including Mr. Banarsi Das Gupta, the ex-chief minister of Haryana, Murari Lal Bansal, and Pundit Mohan Lal, the ex-finance minister of Punjab. So this man was very well connected, had all these big politicians there. So Mr. Goyal had invited Prabhupada to come and bless his home, and Prabhupada was happy to oblige. We got a nice surprise when we stepped inside the house. Mr. Goyal took Srila Prabhupada into a small room at the side, where he revealed a set of 4 feet high, beautiful white marble Radhakrishna deities. Prabhupada went into the deity room and he stood for a few moments before their lordships. The deities were being taken care of by a pujari, but to a simple standard, and Prabhupada encouraged the priests to learn the standards practiced in our ISKCON temples. Returning outside, Prabhupada sat on an armchair in the driveway, and he spoke for a few minutes to the gathering. He gave a wonderful explication of the meaning and purpose of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Hare. Hara means Srimati Radharani, the pleasure potency of the Lord, the transcendental potency. And Ram, it means if you use this word Ram, you will get unlimited pleasure. Ramante Yogino Param. The great yogis emerged in transcendental bliss. Ramante Yogino Param. So this is the eternal bliss. The enjoyment of this material world is only for the time being, and it is a shadow of true pleasure. The real pleasure is the Lord. So the meaning of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is O Krishna, O Radharani, O Ram. The Mayavadis say the Lord has no energy. This is false. Actually, the Lord is the supreme energetic. The Upanishads say Parashya Shakti Vividaya Shruyate. So the Param Brahma Lord has many forms of energy. Chit Shakti, Achit Shakti, and Jiva Shakti. By his Chit Shakti, he created the Vaikuntha planets, and the marginal energy, the Jivas, are sometimes situated in the Vaikuntha planets, and sometimes they're on the material planets. They are called Tatastha energy. For instance, there are many people who are devotees of the Lord, and there are many people who do not accept the Lord. Even those who do not accept the Lord will accept him in due course of time if they undergo the proper guidance. So this characteristic that they are not accepting, but they will accept later on, is called tatasta. It is not that those who do not accept the Lord, that means the demons and the fallen, will remain demons. No, for them, the demigods are there. So the purpose of this Hare Krishna movement is to convert demons into demigods. That's it. As a madman can be treated by medicine, and when the disease is gone, then the sane man can be useful to do anything. Similarly, the rascals and the demonic people who do not accept the Lord, and whose numbers are increasing these days on this planet, they can be treated by the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. By chanting this Maha Mantra, their hearts will be cleansed. Chaito Darpana Marjanam. Darpana means mirror, and Chaito means heart. So a heart is like a mirror. Since many, many births, this dust has covered the surface of the mirror, so we have to cleanse that. And what is the method to do that? That is the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. If you chant the Hare Krishna Mantra, then this Chaito Darpana, the mirror of your heart, will become cleansed. You see, so many demons are there who never accept the Lord. If they once understand the supremacy of the Lord, then their lives will be successful. So you yourself chant this Maha Mantra, and you teach the same to your children. So, the meaning of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is, O my Lord, O Srimati Radharani, please engage me in your transcendental service of your lotus feet. I am fed up with service to Maya, so please engage me now in loving devotional service of your lotus feet. So, very nice explanation of the meaning and purpose of the Hare Krishna Mantra. Okay, so we're going to finish at this point. Does anybody have any questions or comments before we move on to the prasadam? Yes, sir.
Who said that that Vasu Prabhu was deprogrammed? So in the way that you said that he forgot, apparently. They should be treating in some kind of medicines just to forget all the things.
Okay, the question was, how did Vasu Gopal kind of forget that he was a devotee? What they used to do was they would capture devotees, and then sometimes they would get, forget the technical name, but they would get an order from the court declaring that they were temporarily insane. Because if, they were adults legally, then of course the parents couldn't interfere with what they were doing. But there are some circumstances when a parent can apply to the court, even if the child is an adult, and have a court order putting them under their care temporarily on the grounds of mental illness. Britney Spears was put under that, to cite a famous example. In England they call it being sectioned. I'm not sure, I can't remember the name in America. So they would, it's like a conservatorship or something. Yeah. So in America, they would go to, the parents would go to some, sympathetic judge. They would explain, my child's become mad following this weird cult. They've been captured and brainwashed, blah, blah, blah. So then they would say, all right, 30 days, sectioned. And then they had a legal right to, grab them and take them away. So we had a few incidences of devotees selling, out in Sankirtan, and all of a sudden a car would pull up. These thugs would jump out, grab them, throw them in the car, and drive off with them. And then they would put them through, this very heavy so-called deprogramming. They would keep them up and awake for several days at a time, wouldn't let them sleep. They would take pictures of Krishna and Prabhupada and tear them up and spit on them and throw them on the floor and stamp on them. They would force them to eat meat. They would force them to drink liquor. If they started chanting, they would, cram their mouths with ice cubes. I mean, it was really violent stuff. And I guess after a month of that, you know, Basu got just bewildered, you know, just all the pressure on him. So he kind of, you know, at one point, you know, he just said, okay, you know, I give up. And he surrendered to the deprogrammers. And then, you know, he convinced them that he was normal, and then they let him out. Then, you know, of course, as soon as he met a devotee in the airport, then it all came back to him. And he, you know, he asked them to take him back to the temple. So, you know, temporarily, you know, somebody can get a little bewildered. But Krishna consciousness is so strong that even if you take another birth, right, if you forget Krishna and you have to take another birth, at some point, you know, in that next lifetime, Krishna consciousness will revive again. Yeah, although you're so bewildered that you've forgotten all about it, but at some point Krishna will again come back and revive your memory of him. So that's the blessing. Yeah, otherwise, you know, we're very small. And as Prabhupada said, tatasta means marginal. Yeah, sometimes wet, sometimes dry. So that's our position. We're very minute, and therefore we have a tendency to get overwhelmed sometimes by Maya. But Krishna consciousness is so powerful that that Maya cannot remain. And again, you can come back. All right? Yes, sir. What's your name again, Prabhu?
Back to Michael.
Back to Michael. We've met before, though, haven't
we? Yeah,
we've
met.
Yeah, yeah, all right.
One thing I was going to say was, you just said then that even if you forget Krishna, and then in the next lifetime you'll run into a Krishna and it'll trigger something, you might come back.
Yeah.
What I was wondering was, if you come across any devotees that have come to Krishna now, and if they've been back, realised it, then they thought, wow, I can remember it. I can remember actually being a devotee in some other lifetime.
Have I met any devotees that can remember having served Krishna in a previous life?
Yeah.
I haven't personally. I know when I joined the temple, and you know, the day that I joined and I walked through the door, I had a very distinct feeling of having just finally come back to something that I'd left off, you know, previously. It was like, you know, waking up. You know, I've been asleep and it was like suddenly waking up, and I had a very distinct feeling that I was taking up where I'd left off. Many devotees have that. But there was one case in England where I don't forget all the details, but it was somebody that joined the temple who remembered being a brahmachari in the early 70s in England, and they were serving, and then somehow or another something happened, they died, took birth again as a woman, and then this woman after 20 years came back, and she actually remembered that she was this brahmachari in a previous life. There was a case like that. Yeah, I forget exactly the circumstances how it happened. There was some traumatic event that happened to her, and then it brought back all these memories of who she was in a previous life.
Yeah, why I ask that is because lots of the devotees in the scriptures that we read about were previous devotees in another
yes.
Lives, you know, so Prahlad was this and so on. And I wondered if he's come up, how many might remember those things. Like, for instance, some of the devotees that are around now might have also been Prahlad Maharaj or this or that in a previous lifetime.
Well, again in England in the mid-80s, there was a gentleman, what was his name, Leonard Wilder. He used to do hypnotic regressions, and he was given permission to, you know, regress all the devotees at the manor, and he did many of them, and he would take them back to their previous lives. Yeah, and many of them, you know, they had recollections under hypnosis of, you know, previous devotional activities. So
not all of it would have been the previous life, would have been in a whole another,
well,
time
whatever.
Zone, another whole everything.
Individually, you know, either previous life or before that, But it's there, and it does say in the Nectar of Devotion that in order to take up devotional service in this life, one must have already performed some devotional service in previous lives. Because there is a starting point, but there's a gradual build-up, Agyata Sukriti. Sukriti is the qualification for taking up devotional service. Agyata Sukriti means that it's unknowingly acquired. So by eating prasadam, by hearing the chanting, you know, whatever, doing some service, bowing down before the deities or whatever.
Jaw.
Huh?
Or block jaw, rock jaw.
Yeah, and, yeah, square jaw. He got some, you know, somehow or another, he was always chanting Hare Krishna. So he's got the benefit now.
I spoke to him about it.
You have?
Yeah.
What does he say about his previous activities?
He said, oh, that's the past, now it's different.
All right, good. Yeah, he's put it behind him.
But I will say one thing, though. It's not just the Hare Krishnas that's changed the amount of harassment and stuff, you know, though, because when we go on Harinam now in Swanson Street, years ago I sold Herald's there when I was a young boy. Herald's Prateek down in Port And but what used to happen then, there was council, investigators used to come around and arrest the Herald boys. They'd come and pull a bloke with one arm, used to go around, and he was the same as this guy, you know, or the one that took over. And he'd come with a measure, and he'd measure, you know, put your papers, your books on the ground,
yeah.
And sell your Herald. He'd come with a tape measure, and if you were half an inch over, you got a fine, which was like your whole week's wages.
Yes.
For being a half an inch too big. I see them now with the buskers and everybody, they put up big stalls in Swanson Street. They got, if you're one half an inch or a quarter of an inch over, you got a $20 fine, which was like in next month's salary. So like that. So there's always that, even if it's not just a religious thing or it's a noise, we won't make a noise, you know, but it was like, it's always somebody council bloke that.
Yes, I mean, they got their rules and regulations, and we weren't following them, so that was it, you know. I mean, it wasn't just us that was getting harassed. He was harassing everybody.
Yeah.
There were people out collecting for the blind. He was harassing them, you know, different charitable. You know, they're very strict about it, but, you know, because there were so many of us, we really got, you know, we were really the focus. In fact, I don't know whether they still do it, but in the 70s, apparently the mayors, the Lord Mayors of each city in Australia, they would have an annual meeting, and they would discuss, you know, the problems in running their respective cities. And one year, the Hare Krishnas were the, you know, number one item on the agenda, how to get rid of the Hare Krishnas, you know, from all the cities. So we did have an impact.
You think
that's
like
for
the
sure.
Romans trying to get rid of the Christians.
What year did Prabhupada take part in the Rathyatra in Melbourne?
What year did Prabhupada take part in the Rathyatra in Melbourne? 1974.
Just before that, they were in Moonsdale Street building a chariot. I don't know if you read the story. I've seen a newspaper clipping. There was a finer building. 8 or 10 devotees hang on to the blanket. About 10 people jump 4 stories onto the blanket.
Yeah, that was in Little Lonsdale Street. That was that wasn't a blanket. What happened was that we had on Little Lonsdale Street, we had a storefront and a couple of floors above. It had previously been the studio of the Mighty Apollo. And
that's where Jagannath was carved there.
Yes, it was right in his gym, like old gymnasium there. And Prabhupada came. And the devotees, it was the last few days just before the Rathyatra. And the women, Bhai Babi was there with a couple of other women, and they were sewing the canopies for the Rath carts. And then all of a sudden they heard all this commotion outside. They went out. And about 3 shops further up the road and on the first floor, there was all smoke coming, and there was some fire going on, and there was a bunch of women that were trapped up there. And so she ran in, they grabbed the canopy of the Rath cart, and they ran out and held that, and then told them to jump, and several of them actually did jump down and they were saved.
Because I have a newspaper at Crossway.
Oh, you do? Oh, yeah. All right, because excellent.
There's a lot of things like that I've put for the younger people to read.
Because that wasn't the only fire that week.
Yeah, it was page one of the Age. That's
no, but I'm saying it wasn't the only fire that week. There was another fire that was not reported.
Oh, really?
And that was, we were out in Carlton. I was in charge of building the Rath carts. And we were out in Carlton, and we used to sleep on the Rath site. So in the last few nights before the event, because there was so much work to do, that we were just sleeping there on the Rath carts or in the van. And maybe two nights before the parade, we'd stop working about midnight, and there was a Ramania and a couple of other ladies. They were sleeping on one of the chariots. We didn't what we had was, you know, the chariots were completed, but the canopies were not fitted yet. But we had some kind of canvas, kind of forming a shelter, and so they were sleeping under the canvas on the Rath cart, and then some of the other men, they were sleeping on the other Rath cart. I was sleeping in a van at the side of the road, and it was a dead end road. We were at the end, yeah. And then I remember about 1 o'clock in the morning, I hear all this shrieking and yelling, "Harry, sorry, Harry, sorry!" And I jumped, you know, out of the van, and there was a fire going on, and somebody had come in the night, and they'd gotten some fire lighters and wrapped them up in kerosene, rags and kerosine. Put them on the Rath carts where the devotees were actually sleeping and set them on fire. Somehow or another, Ramania had woken up and saw them, and they had not caught fire. I mean, it didn't really catch, and we were able to put it out. And that whilst we were doing that, I looked up the other end of the street, and a van came, or a car came, and stopped, and they were... The occupants were looking down. It was the people that had done it. They were looking to see if the fire had caught. And I jumped in our van, and I chased them down the road. But I lost them in the back streets of Carlton. But, yeah, we nearly went up in flames. I mean, it was a bit of a fiery week that week. So that was an unknown, you know, wasn't reported in the newspapers. We had opposition like that. You know, there was again, it was some parents or something. Around about the same time, we had a firebomb attack on the Burnett Street Temple. One night, we were up on the first floor, and we heard a smash. And I ran down, and the whole front of the front door was aflame. Yeah, somebody had thrown a Molotov cocktail on the door. And so the next night I decided maybe they'll come back. So I left the door slightly ajar, and I slept right behind the door. And sure enough, they came back. And I, again, the same thing, I heard this smash and then flames. I opened the door, and then I made a mistake. I should have just run after whoever it was. I maybe would have got them. But then I thought, if I run, then, you know, the flames are going up, everybody else is asleep. So I started yelling, you know, "Brahmacharis, Brahmacharis, there's a fire." So I lost about 5 or 10 seconds. And when I ran down the street, whoever it was had already gone. But they didn't come back because it was too close for them. You know, I immediately jumped up and started yelling. So they must have run off, took fright. We had in Dank Street... just not long after we, moved in there, maybe a year or two afterwards, we had this big fight going on with this idiot that used to live behind us. He hired some thugs. They threw a bomb over the back wall. It landed on one of the bonnet of one of the vehicles and blew it off. Wow. Yeah, and I was there. I think this was 77 or 78. Where the temple room is, then the stairway that leads upstairs to the is it still the Brahmachari quarters up there? Used to be. Alright, Prasadam Hall, but it was the Brahmachari quarters. Yeah. So that little room halfway up was my room. I was the GBC. And and I remember one night I was in my sleeping bag, and then I heard this boom, boom, like this. And I jumped up. I remember I was asleep, and I jumped up straight up on my feet. I was still in my sleeping bag. And I thought that sounded like a gunshot. I went out. I went out the front, couldn't see anything. I heard a screeching of tires and a car driving away. So I went out and I looked around. I couldn't see anything. I walked along the top of the wall in front of Prabhupada House. I couldn't see anything. Our neighbor came out. I saw he was looking around. He had heard something, but he didn't see it. I thought, what was that? So anyway, I went back to sleep. Then in the morning, Balaram told me, you know, to come and look at Prabhupada's room. So they had pulled up and blasted a shotgun through the windows of Prabhupada's room. There were pellet holes all over the ceiling. All the windows were blown in because they'd seen the light was on. And they thought somebody was in the room, so they actually shot at it because they thought somebody was in there.
So there's more than one stuck room was fired at.
Yeah, that was actually a high heat man.
Yes, yes. I mean, there was all kinds of things going on.
There's a bullet hole in the window now.
Is there?
Yeah. It's a 22. It's on the red glass, left-hand side when you're looking at it, on the red glass of where the bullet went through.
I'll check it out when I get back. Yeah. there was lots of opposition. You know, the spiritual...
I spoke about that one the day the 22 was fired. Uh-huh. He said he was in the room, and when the bullet came through...
He was in the room.
Yeah, he was in the room doing japa.
Alright. Anyway, there are demons and there are devotees.
The demons, devotees that don't realize it yet.
Yes. Okay, so we're going to finish there. Thank you all very much for coming, and we'll have prasadam. And tomorrow morning we'll continue on at the temple with the seminar on chanting, and the next section is about chanting japa. So that will begin tomorrow. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
His Grace Hari Sori Prabhu ki
jai.